Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks, offering cool climate wines that capture the essence of Oregon since 2002. In this episode, we feature filmmaker Barbara Koppel. Portions of this episode contain explicit language, graphic audio of violence, and content which may not be suitable for all audiences. Koppel is part of the leading edge of a new generation of documentary filmmakers, what she calls nonfiction filmmaking, in the 1970s and 80s. Her cohort included Leon Gast, Michael Moore, Peter Gilbert, and Steve James, and others who, as a close-knit group of artists, pushed their films into wide release in mainstream theaters. Their group changed what we watched and proved that there was, in fact, a huge audience for this kind of filmmaking. Koppel is also an important pioneer as a woman who pushed into a male-dominated industry and went on to win many awards, including the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. She is generous about her success, giving credit to her colleagues who supported her and becoming a mentor for other women filmmakers. In this talk, Koppel takes us on a tour of her career by bringing us behind the scenes to show how her films are made and the stories behind them. What binds her work, I think, is the way she gives voice to those who traditionally have not always been heard. Be they returning soldiers or striking coal miners in Kentucky, Koppel places herself at great personal risk to capture these stories for us, and the films are searing for this reason. They have also stood the test of time, having an eerie relevance today. In one clip from our 1972 film Winter Soldier, a veteran says, in discussing the politically polarized and contentious atmosphere he returned to after Vietnam, quote, "The key to growing and being a better person is talking to people who are different, not to people who are the same." Indeed, that seems just as true today. Here's Koppel.
Well, I'm really, really delighted to be here. And it's so great to be able to say the word documentary. Because usually when people think about documentaries, what they think about is, it must be good for you, or we're going to learn something, and that sort of makes people want to hold them at hand's length. And we've also devised a new way to describe what we do, which is called nonfiction filmmaking. It means that it's simply like any other film, except there's no actors and there's no script. And what you're able to do is really capture life, real life. And you also have to be quick enough and together enough to get it, because real life has a habit of not repeating itself. You can't sort of say, okay, cut, take two. And so you just have to really be on your toes. Nonfiction films are really sort of moving into the mainstream. All of us who make them are very close with each other and very supportive with each other, because when one of them does well, we feel that they all do well. And, you know, just recently you may have seen Peter Gilbert and Steve James' Hoop Dreams, or Leon Gast's When We Were Kings, the story of Muhammad Ali, or Michael Moore's Roger and Me, or The Big One. And all of us look at each other's work, we criticize each other's work, and we just do everything in our power to help these films succeed. Harlan County, when it was nominated for an Academy Award, they put all the documentarians in the same row, and when our category came up, we all just crisscrossed hands to show our support. And when they announced my film, they sort of just eased me forward. But it's wonderful to be part of this world of making nonfiction films. So whenever you see them in the theater, go support them. I started, I guess my first film was when I was in college. I went to a university in Boston where you had to work 6 months in the field that you were studying. And I was studying clinical psych and political science. And the people that I went and I visited had gotten lobotomies. And I figured, oh, if I write about these people, nobody's going to ever read it. Nobody's going to see the things that I'm seeing and I'm feeling. And so I figured that the only way to really document it was to do a little movie on it. So I got a little Hi8 camera and started filming the people and filming their families. And for me, it showed, you know, who they were before through their families and their isolation and now their despair and depression. And I really thought that this could really tell people things and communicate things. So I brought it to class on the day that our papers were due, and my professor was outraged. I got a D. He felt that I had really, you know, taken an easy way out. But for me, it was the most wonderful thing that ever could have happened because I was hooked. I was hooked on wanting to tell stories about people that you ordinarily don't get to hear. I was hooked about watching people in times of crisis become heroes and just watching how average flesh and blood people react in their lives. And all of this to me was incredible. And then being able to have the experience of turning out all the lights and putting the work that you do on a screen and having for a moment with the people that are in the theater a collective experience where no matter who we are, or where we come from, or you know, what we've experienced in our lives, in that moment we're all experiencing something together and it gives us a kind of sanity point to really discuss things. It's a real communal experience, and for me it was thrilling. I did a film with a group of people, a collective film, which was a very important film to me, called Winter Soldier. It was about Vietnam veterans giving testimony of war crimes they committed in the early 70s. A very unpopular film. PBS station in New York was the only one that ever showed it, and the Cannes Film Festival gave it a prize called Critics' Choice. We lived with the veterans while we were editing it, and sometimes early in the morning we'd wake them up and they'd still have their guns, so they thought. And really what it was for me was seeing boys my age become killers and just lose that innocence. And I'm gonna show you a clip from Winter Soldier. It's tape 1A. And this is a young kid named Scott Camille.
We did. I saw a lot of things happening and being done by guys. And I really, you know, like the emotional thing, you know, you see your buddy get killed and it's really emotional. Someone you're really good friends with, like one minute he's telling you, well, you know, I got a letter from my girl. I'm really happy, you know, and I can't wait to see her. And she's going to send me some pictures she's taken. She's getting her girlfriend to take some nice Polaroid pictures of me, you know, and then the you go out and he gets shot in the head. And you know, it was really hard for you to realize that, you know, 5 minutes ago he was your friend and now he's dead. And you'd put him on the helicopter and just make believe he went home. You try not to think that he was killed. And then you say, well, I'm gonna get the gooks for it. And you just take it out on all the gooks. And it got to be where it was like someone would say, okay, you know, you come stay on my farm and you can go hunting every day for free and I'll give you all the ammo you want. And you can hunt and there's no limit and you can go out together and just hunt, you know, and that's what it was like, a hunting trip. And the more people we killed, the happier our officers were, you know. It got to be like a game, like the object was to see who could kill the most people. And the different ways you could prove how many people you killed would be like cutting off ears. Now if you brought back someone's ears, you know, pretty likely you had to kill them to get them. And then people would, you know, whoever had the most ears, they would get the most beers, and you'd trade your ears for beers. And it got to be like a game. And when it came time to go home, I was very close to my friends, and I knew what I was doing, you know, like I was like an expert. My job being a forward observer is also a scout sergeant, and you have to learn to read maps and know the area. And I got where I knew where I was without looking at the maps, and I could call in artillery just by knowing where I was. And I was really attached to my friends. I couldn't see leaving my friends and going home. And then I thought about the political thing again. I said, well, you know, and I wrote my mother a letter. And I told her, I said, I'm not coming home in April because I really believe what we're doing is right. and I think it's better for me to stay here and help get it cleaned up if I can than for my brother to have to come over when he gets old enough. And that's what I wrote, and that's what was put in the newspaper, and they had a big article, you know, we need more Americans like this.
What was your rank
okay.
when you first went?
Thanks. So that was extremely harrowing for us as young filmmakers to hear. This was a film that Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland helped support. I was really very, very young at this time. And Donald Sutherland, you know, kept sort of following me around, and I thought, oh, it's because I'm so young that, you know, maybe he's going to fire me, even though nobody was making any money anyway. But so I kept avoiding him, and I was doing sound and assistant camera work and, you know, just everything I could to keep busy and to be part of it because it was so important to me. I didn't want to have to leave. And then finally I was in the hotel room because we were all in hotel rooms, and I was changing the film in the magazine, which means I couldn't leave because I was in a changing bag. And Donald Sutherland came over to me and he sat down. And I figured, oh no, he's caught me. And he said, I've been trying to talk to you for, you know, the last couple of days, and you're always too busy or you're always running away. And he said, I just wanted to tell you that I've been watching you and you're really very good. And he said, so I just wanted to give you a little bit of, you know, praise. And for me, that was incredible because I thought the opposite was going to happen, and it just gave me at that very young age, you know, a sense that I could do something and a sense of self and a sense that, you know, I shouldn't be afraid to try things in my life. And it just, he probably would never even remember the moment, but it was something that stuck with me for a long time. One of the other things that Vietnam veterans had problems with when they came back was being able to communicate. As we all remember, the mood of the country was, you know, very anti-war, and people were polarized, and Vietnam veterans were in a terrible situation because they had gone through so much, seen so much, and were coming home not as war heroes like people in World War II. And this is a clip about a young man who finally learns what it means to communicate. And this is tape number one.
For 6 years, my hair never got longer than a quarter of an inch. And I always swore I'd keep it that short. But I like it long now. It feels nice. When I was in the Marine Corps, and when I first got out of the Marine Corps, I didn't want to talk to anybody who didn't think that Agnew sitteth at the right hand of God. If I was walking down the center of Cambridge, where I live, and some long-haired kid was walking toward me, and he wouldn't get out of the way, I'd knock his ass right into the gutter. And one day, I did that, and a kid said to me, that makes it sort of hard for us to get to know each other. And I thought that was a joke, and I kept on walking. And I was lying in bed, talking with my wife, and she said, you know, he's really right. Which was, you know, a simple thing, and that might have gone right over me and never affected me whatsoever, but my wife has a fantastic way of helping me and teaching me how to enjoy life. And that's the key to growing and being a better person, is talking to people who are different, not to people who are the same.
Okay. Thank you. So I also took Rusty's advice. I grew up in Scarsdale, New York, which is in Westchester County, and it's sort of a somewhat affluent suburb where, you know, everything is sort of doted on the child, and I had parents who did everything and still do everything they could for me and gave me a real sense of self so that I could take risks. And I decided that I really wanted to do films that were so far from what I understood and what I knew to sort of bring me closer and to make me be able to communicate. So off I went to bloody Harlan County in eastern Kentucky, where the last camera crew that went in to eastern Kentucky, the cameraman was killed for walking on somebody's land. And there was a movement within the coal fields known as Miners for Democracy. A man named Jock Yablonski had run against the powers that be in the United Mine Workers, and for doing that, he was killed, and his wife and daughter were killed. And that's what brought about the Miners for Democracy. And these were just rank-and-file coal miners who had never had any experience coming up and saying, we're going to make changes and we're going to do something. Arnold Miller ran and he won. He was a coal miner who had black lung, which is from breathing, you know, coal dust called pneumocomiosis in the coal mines, and he got in. And he decided that he was going to organize the unorganized. And myself being a very young political woman, I wanted to see whether he was going to sell out now that he had gotten into power, or whether he was going to keep his promise and really do something in the coal fields. And so off I went to Harlan County. And when I first got to Harlan County and introduced myself to people, nobody would talk to me. The women would give me phony names. They'd say they were Florence Nightingale or Martha Washington. And then they said to me, okay, come down to the picket line. You need to be there at, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning, and we'll meet you there. And so we were staying in this place, a little motel on something called Pine Mountain. And so at like 3:30 or something in the morning, we came down Pine Mountain. Pine Mountain had no guardrails. It had been raining. The road was really wet. And this other car just came speeding past us. And we flipped over and sort of fell. The car fell upside down. And we were all right. There was only three of us. And we crawled out of the car. And because I had made a promise that I was going to be on the picket line, I made everybody, including myself, carry all our gear and everything 3 miles to the picket line. And news travels fast in eastern Kentucky. And when they found out what had happened and what we had done, suddenly just everything opened up to us. We ended up, you know, living with the miners, and they fed us and they protected us. It was also a very dangerous place. The organizers from the United Mine Workers called me into their room one night and opened this big bag and showed me their arsenal and asked me which gun I would like to have. And so I took a .357 Magnum. So don't mess with me. But I never had to use it. Anyway, in Harlan County, people live and die by their guns. And early one morning, we were machine gunned with semi-automatic carbines with tracer bullets that lit up the mountainsides. And the head gun thug sort of held a gun at my head. And you can hear me screaming on film, "Don't shoot." And then they sort of went across the bridge and came back and got us first, because, you know, nobody wants to commit murder, you know, in living color. So they figured they would, you know, get us out. And I thought, oh, I brought all these people down here. And so when they were coming across the bridge and I do sound, I just walked forward. And of course, they got me quickly. And I got up and I was so mad. I had a Nagra tape recorder from here to here and a long fish pole with a mic. And I just started swinging it. And they were kicking me, but it didn't hurt because, you know, the tape recorder was there. Also, the women in Harlan County were just the most incredible. They were the most forceful. If it hadn't been for those women, they would have never won the strike. It took the life of a young coal miner to win that strike, because all bedlam would have broken out, because after he was killed, everybody was picking up guns. And I'm going to show you a clip. It's clip number 2 from Harlan County.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You carry it with you. Oh, it's got safety. And if it did, it wouldn't shoot nothing. I might lose that one anyway. As long as I got nothing.
I want you to move the needle, Lord.
Oh, tell them I started out with a switch on that picket line, but I mended up now, carrying a gun. I mean, all the time, too. Hell, you have to, you know, especially since what's happening up there at High Snap, and knowing them and seeing them machine guns and all. It's time to... Well, you'd be crazy not to carry a gun now. Yeah. Well, all right. I'll be going up. Are y'all going to be back at 6?
You know that nigger?
That nigger is better man than you'll ever be. He's a better man than you'll ever be.
Three or four damn old gun thugs get on him and start kicking a woman and hitting a woman, and then another one come over and start beating a man and getting four or five of them on him, and then see a Basil Collins holding a gun and calling a union man that believes in these union men, saying, "I want you to get that nigger. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of it. And it's time for us to stand together and get just as violent as they are. They're violent, so by God, you fight far with far."
It seemed like they were pretty well organized to me this morning. And we're going to have to get a little tighter organized. We're going to get together, the women are going to get together and be responsible for 10 women each, or 10 people up there each at 4 o'clock.
If you women going to bring 10 each, then the men ought to be able to say, well, we'll bring 5, or we'll bring 10, or we'll bring 15. And that would be working together.
You're gonna have to get some more black people out too,
because
you look
odd.
I am
odd. Okay. Thanks. This strike for the coal miners was so important because all that they wanted was the right to have a union. And coal mining is one of the most dangerous industries in the country. A man or a woman dies almost every other day in a coal mine, either from a rock fall or methane gas. And, you know, the wages are terrible. And if you don't have a union and there's a bad roof or something and you have a lot of kids or something, a foreman or a supervisor can just say, "Hey, Joe, you know, you should go work under that. And if you don't, you're fired and somebody else will take your place." And coal mining is just about all that you can do in a lot of these towns. And when people go to work, you never say, "Have a good day." You always say, "Have a safe day." And so getting this union in Bloody Harlan County, which was notoriously anti-union, was something that was quite incredible. I still stay very much in touch with the people there because we just lived through something that was so incredible. When the film showed, it had its premiere in New York at Alice Tully Hall at the New York Film Festival. And at first I didn't think the New York Film Festival was even going to screen it because as a filmmaker you're always poor and you're always struggling, particularly when you do documentaries. And so I had to show it to them in a rough cut before it was actually finished. And they said, "Oh no, we don't see films like this." And then I found out that they were seeing another film like that. And so I called the New York State Council on the Arts and said, "I want them to look at it. They're looking at this film like that. Will they look at this one?" And So the New York State Council on the Arts made sure that at least the film got screened. And I remember bringing it up, and I had to leave, and then I came back, and there were all these people just standing around when I came back, and I thought, oh no, you know, the splices broke, or the sound didn't go through. And the people said, oh, they loved it. They said, Richard Rad, the head of the festival, only went to the bathroom once during the film. And so I ran, you know, back downtown and told the people that I was working with, and then the call came saying, you know, we'd really love to have this film in the New York Film Festival. And because they had treated me so badly, I sort of said, well, I don't know if I want to show it. And Richard Rad said, Barbara, don't be silly. And I said, yeah, you're right. I won't. Anyway, so I've had the coal miners and their wives come to New York. They had never been to New York before. We all sort of slept in sleeping bags on my floor, and I was a nervous wreck as to what if they didn't like it, or, you know, I just didn't know even how an audience would respond to it. It was like so many years in the making to try to make it happen. And so the film showed, and Hazel Dickens did the music. The film has incredible music because in the coal fields, people communicate through their music. And so I Xeroxed the last song of the film, which she wrote for the film, They'll Never Keep Us Down, and asked the ushers to put them into the programs. And at the end of a film at the New York Film Festival, usually if people, you know, like it, you're in a little box high up, and they shine a little light on you, and people clap if they like the film. But I just felt that this wasn't that kind of film. So what we did is we sort of came on stage, much to Richard Rad's chagrin, at the end of the film, and we were singing as the credits were rolling, They'll Never Keep Us Down. And then we asked the audience to please start and told them about, you know, the page in their playbills. And the whole of Alice Tully Hall were singing with us that song. And then Lois Scott, the woman who you saw take the gun out of her dress, had just been made secretary treasurer of the Black Lung Association. And so she started soliciting money from the people at Alice Tully Hall. And I was in the corner just laughing hysterically, and I think she didn't realize, you know, she had a mic on. And she said, Barbara, you stop that laughter. Pick up those dollar bills and stuff them in your bra. Anyway, we really had a wonderful time. Another woman in the film, Sudie Krusenberry, who's just incredibly beautiful person, died about 5 years ago. And I was in San Francisco, and they tracked me down and wanted me to come and do the eulogy for Sudie, but I couldn't get back in time, so I wrote something and I sent it. And then her whole family got on the phone with me, and they said, Sudie was so moved by this film and by being part of this film that anybody who ever came to Harlan County, the first place they had to stop was with Sudie and go sit on her porch as she went through a scrapbook of every single clipping that, you know, newspaper article that had ever been written about Harlan County. So even in, you know, the worst of times when you think nobody cares about the things that, you know, you do, or nobody's going to see them, or there's never any money to do them with, you remember getting through it and persevering. And those are the things that, you know, give you so much strength and really allow you to pull you through those very, very hard times. After Harlan County, I decided to do another huge venture on my own, like Harlan County, which was a film called American Dream. And American Dream was a very complicated and very difficult film because it was a film that took place in Austin, Minnesota, the Hormel meatpacking plant. And people's grandfathers and fathers had worked there, and it's a very profitable company, but they decided to because they had to remain competitive, that they were going to cut the people's wages from 10.69 to 8.25. And the people were just really angry and really mad, and they weren't going to take it, and they were going to fight back. Then there was also a parent union who was dealing with places like Iowa Beef. And Iowa Beef is a non-union meatpacking plant, and they were paying their workers $6 an hour. And the whole meatpacking industry was in disarray. And so the parent union said, you guys can't do this. You guys have to help us so that we get everybody else union and bring all the wages up. And so then there was a fight between the local and the parent union. And then the company also just wanted to make profits, and they, of course, didn't want the local union to do anything. And for me, this was a very difficult film because I was privy to what was happening in every single camp of this pitched battle. And it really made me think about sort of the morals and the ethics of, you know, being a filmmaker and, you know, knowing things ahead of time that are going to happen to people that I care about and I trust, and, you know, how do I deal with that? And then to make matters worse, there was also a group called P10 who lived in Austin, Minnesota, which was a very small town, that sided with the parent union. And they were always ostracized and, you know, not treated very well. It wasn't always easy to film people. The parent union didn't want me to film them at all, and I would pretend, I would go to their meetings, and I would pretend that I didn't care. And I would say, okay, fine, you don't want us to film, then your opinion won't be in here, and people will just hiss you when they see the film and whatever, and somehow they bought that, and they let me start filming. One of the most incredible pieces, I think, in this film for me, and something that really showed how I was changing as a filmmaker and a person, was filming these P10 people when they were trying to make the decision of whether to go across the picket line. Their grandfathers were union, their fathers were union, and they were union. And they just didn't know what to do. They were torn up inside, nobody would listen to them, and they were making this really huge decision. When I was in Harlan County, I never would have filmed anybody who wanted to go across the picket line. And I'm going to show you this scene from American Dream. It's number 3.
If things haven't changed substantially in 2 or 3 days, I will base my decision on the fact that my family is number 1 in my life, not my union.
Are you going to go across the picket line?
So it appears that at this stage of the game, it would be tough, but I can't see any alternative.
And now that we've been working on this for a year and a half, trying to figure out the difference between right and wrong, I believe that I was a dupe, I was lied to originally, and now he's got control of my whole life. But on the other hand, it's a question of morality, because I was brought up that you do not cross the picket line no matter what. It's just something that you do not do.
Because you don't belong to a union all these years and develop all these principles. It isn't like a dollar bill that you've had in your billfold. You just can't take it out and throw it on the ground and be rid of
it. No. As much as I want my job back, I've still been a good union member for many years. But I don't know. My family comes first.
My daughter goes to work. She's got a part-time job. My boy, he works at McDonald's part-time job. My wife goes to work, she's got a job. And what do? I sit home and I play with a cat. What kind of provider is that?
It may sound corny, but a person takes a lot of pride in being a breadwinner, in providing for your family. But you can't do that when you say to them, all I want to do is go to work.
It's tough, but I want to go back to work. And the hell with P9. I'm ready.
Is that hard for you?
You bet.
Why?
Not being able to, provide for my family. I just can't talk no more.
You new employees or you?
No, no.
Not by any stretch of the imagination.
To some, staying out no longer makes sense. There is more here than a town divided, as brother watches brother cross the line in a place not big enough for anyone to hide for very long.
He won't be my brother if he crosses the line.
For me, it wasn't tough to get, you know, get to the point of the gate. I was ready to go, but the minute we crossed that line, just, you know, some part of me just stayed back there.
Well, unionism unionism to me is watching out not only for your own job, but you're an organization for the welfare and benefit of all the workers. And now, for this, you know, for this moment, we aren't, because we left them.
Okay. So as you can see, the stuff gets very complicated and very textured, and you know, you really want to take a responsibility as a filmmaker too, to be able to portray people in a very truthful way. When I was on the road doing public relations for American Dream, there was a woman who kept trying to find me because she had a project that she wanted me to do. And this project would be the first project that I actually got a salary for and actually had a budget. So that was something quite new. And it was something totally divorced from anything I had ever done before. And she reached me and she said to me, "So Barbara, how would you like to do a film about Mike Tyson?" And I had to think about that for a moment, and I said, "Yes, absolutely, I'd love to do it." And this was during the time that Mike Tyson was in jail for the rape of Desiree Washington. And when I would think about Mike Tyson during that time, I would think about, okay, great, he got what he deserved, finally, you know, somebody put him in jail, and I didn't like boxing very much and didn't really think much about it. But when Diane called me and asked me whether I would like to do this project, I had to just let everything that I had thought about him out of my mind and start from the beginning. Because what was the most important thing for me was really to go beyond the headlines and go beyond the tabloids and really try to find out who this kid is and what he's about, and in a way that nobody else could. And something that I really like to do is sort of look under a blanket where you're not supposed to see and pull things out. And that's what I tried to do in the Mike Tyson piece. So one of the things that we thought that we wanted to do was really tell a very intimate story about Mike Tyson. And I had heard about a German cameraman who had done a film at Customatos, and it was basically about, and it was quite a few years ago, Mike Tyson would have been 12 at the time, but it wasn't about Mike, it was about a young white boy who wanted to be a boxer, and Customato then at his house had lots of young boys who wanted to be boxers. And so this guy filmed the young kid, but also filmed a lot of Mike Tyson and others as well. And so I had to figure out how to trace him. And so what we did was we hired a private investigator who actually found him, and we contacted him, and he said that he had all this material. He didn't, you know what kind of shape it was in or anything, but that we could buy it for something like $10,000. And that was great because NBC was paying for this, and it was, and we had $10,000. So we got all this incredible material of really seeing Mike Tyson at a young age. Anyway, I'm going to show you a piece from the Tyson film. It's a very intimate piece when Mike was quite young. He's about 12 or 13 at the time. It's at the Junior Olympics, and this is number 4.
Everyone that sees me, they say, "Oh boy, you got that Tyson, you're lucky, you know, you got that Tyson, he's an animal, he just loves to fight, he just loves to hurt people, you know, he's not afraid of nothing." But a lot of times he's intimidated. He's intimidated by his opponents. Things go on in his mind like he's not capable as he is, you know. And how you figure, how could a guy like that think he's not capable? Michael! Mike! Don't leave Denver now, come on. Maybe God, you know, gave him such a strong body. He figured, well, I'll give him a strong body and I'll make him have to become strong another way on his own. You know what I mean? He's a little weak personality as far as being, he's easily misled. He needs love. He needs a boost. You know, he needs confidence, somebody to be there with him. Look, just relax, Michael. Relax, just relax.
Relax,
boy. Just relax. Relax. Yeah, but just relax. Just relax.
I'm only first
time. Yeah, well, just relax. Don't get so intense. Relax. You're done in the gym. Better fighters than you're ever gonna fight here. I mean, it's always hard, but I mean, well, you know, you always should have confidence because it always comes out on your side. You're always better than everyone you get in there with, right? Just relax, don't let your imagination get you. Let's go get ready for a fight, come on. A dozen fights. He just knows how to fight. He's very quick for a heavyweight and makes him look like he has more experience than he actually has.
Would you say then he's a natural fighter?
No, I wouldn't say he was a natural. He didn't walk in the gym like that.
Okay, thanks. Another right duck to the body by Tyson.
Very, very strong boxer, Tyson.
I tell you.
Very, very strong.
Brown has taken some vicious punishment and held on. He's
he really
still in
has.
There.
I don't think he's
there's
gonna...
another right by Tyson.
Left,
right.
He's giving up. Vitello's coming in. Look at old Tyson jump on the ropes.
That is it. They threw the towel in.
He didn't want to see. He didn't want to see his boxer hurt.
I think the towel hit the canvas about 35 seconds into the fight.
Look at old Tyson. He's rolling on the ground with joy. Six bouts, six knockouts.
Come here. Now listen. You guys with respect. Come here. National champion, you stick with it, you're gonna have your day. You understand? You have a lot of guts, a lot of guts, a lot to be proud of.
When I'm in the ring, all the nervousness and tension is stopped. It's not there no more. Because I'm facing reality and I'm not, you know, in the locker room thinking about, oh man, this guy's a killer, post this happened or this happened. Else I'm gonna do this. Well, as soon as I get in the ring, it's a whole different story. I'm the killer then.
Okay. Anyway, and this is just showing you scratching the surface because the way that we peeled away at who Mike Tyson is the people who knew him and watched him and for many, many years. Also, I think being a woman really helped me a lot to make this film. Because sort of guys get really macho and, you know, they need to sort of really know a lot about boxing and a woman can ask any question that she wants and people will answer it. I remember my husband, who's this, you know, Irish Catholic guy, one of eight, thinks he, you know, reads the sports page, thinks he knows everything about boxing. And when I started doing the Mike Tyson piece, I didn't know anything very much about boxing. And, you know, I studied and I researched it and I started fighting him for the sports page. And he didn't like that very much because I was walking on his domain. And we went to, you know, a party or something, and when the people found out I was doing a film on Mike Tyson, all the men in the room crowded around me. And my husband sort of stood there saying, oh, how did she get to be the expert on this? But anyway, it is make it a lot easier. I also do, as you can see, a lot of films about men. meat packers, coal miners, boxers. And that's because not that I wouldn't do films about women, because I love women, but men are a mystery to me. And what I'm always trying to do with men is really find out who they are and see where their fragile sides are and see what their human sides are. The next little piece I'm going to show you is a piece that I did pretty recently. It's called Defending Our Daughters, and it's a TV piece for Lifetime Television for Women. And I went to Sarajevo and filmed women where rape was used as a weapon of war. And for me, it was one of the most harrowing experiences. And that's number 6.
My commander told us we should visit the Sonya prison, where we could rape a few women. He said it would be good for morale. He gave us a room and said, do with her as you please. So we gang raped her. We did it like this. The legs like this, and my gun here. Her head like this. The breasts here, and my gun pointed at her, and then I raped her. Afterwards, my friends asked me if I liked it, if it was fun. I had to do it. I was ordered to do so by my commander. He told me I had to do it every day.
There were 4 of us and 12 of them. They were drunk. They were full of blood. It's really difficult for me to talk about this. And then they raped me, one after another. We had to sing for them. And we had to sit on their laps naked. There was no love there, just violence.
We are trying to convince her to understand that the act of rape was not put against her as an individual. It was an act of a political strategy, a systematic attack against the nation and the state. How else would it be possible to explain the rape of a 70-year-old woman by an 18-year-old man?
I can't believe that something like this could happen to me, because they knew me. It would have been easier for me if it was someone I didn't know. These were the boys I gave plums to as children, and they were tearing off my clothes.
Is that your sin or their sin?
It's my sin.
It seems to me like you are blaming yourself for this.
But it is my fault. God will never forgive me.
If you were not religious, would you still think it was your sin?
If I was a Serb, maybe I wouldn't feel guilty and think it is my sin. But I am a Muslim woman. They were tearing off my clothes. I was naked.
Okay. Anyway, within this piece, we did 3 pieces for Lifetime. One was in Sarajevo, one was in Egypt in the U.S. on female genital mutilation, and one was in Pakistan, where it was the selling of women by their fathers to older men. And in each of these situations, there were people who were fighting back, and people who were working, and people who were very radical. And so all of these pieces are filled with a tremendous amount of hope and a tremendous amount of strength. And for the first time, many of these people are telling their stories. It was a very courageous thing for Lifetime to do. They couldn't get any sponsors for it, so they put it on without sponsors. They had an 800 number at the end of the film, and they got more calls on that 800 number from people all over the country wanting to do something, or women in the United States who were Somali or Ethiopian who were going through the ramifications and the scars of female genital mutilation. So I will leave this and take you to sort of a happier place in life, I think. And I'm going to show you a little clip from my Woody Allen film, Wild Man Blues. And once again, that was something that I never thought that I would be asked to do. It wasn't as if one morning I woke up and said, aha, I have to do a film about Woody Allen. It never would have dawned on me. But a friend of mine named Jim Stern, who is a theater producer, he did Stomp and Bunny Bunny and a lot of plays, called me up and he said, you know, how would you like to do a film on Woody Allen? And I said, yeah, right. And he said, no, I'm absolutely serious. Would you like to do it? And he said, it's going to be 23 days, 18 different European cities. He's going on a jazz tour. Are you game? So, of course, if he hadn't said, are you game, I probably would have thought more about it. But he said that, and that was very challenging. So I did it. And 2 days or so after I said yes, Letty Aronson, who's Woody's sister, called up and said, would you like to meet Woody? And I said, yeah, of course, I'd love to. So I went over to his apartment, and we sat and we talked. And we were talking about everything other than this film and this trip. We were talking about this magician, David Blaine, that we both knew. We were talking about politics, philosophy, the weather, and, you know, I knew the audience with him was not going to last forever, so I finally got up the nerve to say something about the trip and the film, and I said to him, so Woody, you know, are you looking forward to going on this trip? And suddenly his whole demeanor changed, and he said, no, I don't want to go. And I said, what do you mean you don't want to go? He said, it's too many cities, it's places I've never been, I don't want to go. And I just knew at that minute that I was going to have a great time. So right now I'm going to show you a little clip from Wild Man Blues, and it's Woody with his parents. So this is number 5.
I'm going to beat Spain. I mean, and now it's history.
She didn't want them to unpack it, you know, alone.
This.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
Here, Dad, we want to show you what we got, what Woody got in Europe. Woody, you want to explain these?
This is a medal from the theater.
It's a medal.
They gave you a medal.
What theater?
It's from a theater in Venice.
Oh.
Well, don't you want it?
Yeah, why not?
I know, but what are you going to do with it?
What is my... I don't know.
No, you put it out here with this other stuff.
This was awarded to me by the fire department in Milan.
Crazy Woody.
No, it says grazie, that's crazy. Yes, here I single-handedly saved some lives in Milan, and the fire department gave me this. There was a terrible, terrible emergency. Actually, what happened was the lights went out, and but I didn't panic and saved the lives of a lot of people from being, you know, stomped to death and trampled to death. Feel that? It's heavy, isn't it?
Oh.
And you always like that kind of lucite stuff.
That was from the theater in Venice that birthday.
You're a very lucky man.
I already engraved this.
Look at the engraving.
Oh, this is from, it's from Madrid.
Well, it was engraved over there, huh?
All he cares about is where it was engraved. What's the difference? This is a D.W. Griffith Award, Distinguished Achievement in Motion Picture. This was given to me for managing to live to 60.
To you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I'm alive and in good health.
Hey, this engraving, whoever did the engraving is beautiful. Let me tell you something, this is real good engraving.
Uh-huh. You know, one would get the feeling he was an engraver.
D.W. Griffith, remember him years ago.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You don't remember me practicing the clarinet in my room?
Yes,
because I do. Yes, you shut the door, I remember. You shut the door, you played, you didn't play it loud.
Yes, I remember the fella coming in. He was a black man.
Gene Cedric is a great, great jazz clarinet player who I called up on the telephone and asked if he would... I saw him play in town. I asked if he would come to the house.
Yeah.
And he only charged me $2 per lesson.
I don't remember.
$2 when he'd come all the way in from Harlem. And,
I remember the man coming to teach
you. Yeah, neither of us could read music or anything, and we would just sit in the living room, and he would try and help me in some way, and he was helpful.
Remember he took tap?
Remember he took a few tap dancing
tap
lessons?
Tap dancing.
Oh, yes, I remember that. You did a lot of good things, but you never pursued them. You never went further.
Had you gone on, you would have been a good tap dancer.
I would have been a tap dancer.
Mm-hmm. You'd have been a tap dancer, which is bad. Tap dancer.
Why is it bad?
It's very hard for people in show business to make a living.
You wanted me to be a pharmacist.
Right, you want him to be a pharmacist.
A pharmacist? Oh,
so you don't remember anything else? You don't remember if I used to listen to the radio a lot and listen to music all the time?
Oh, yes, she listened to that, but I wasn't concerned. You were in your room. You stayed there most of the time, just came out.
You lived in your room.
So
what
you
did
remember?
You have in your room?
What did I have in my room?
Did you have a Victrola?
Yeah, I mean, were you an uninterested parent?
I wasn't an uninterested parent. I took you wherever I thought was good for you.
Like where? What does that mean? Hebrew school?
Like Hebrew school. That was good for you, yes. That was very good.
All that time-wasting junk?
No, that wasn't time-wasting.
So would you say that you were the exact wrong kind of parents for me?
What?
Would you say that you were the exact wrong kind of parent?
I was too strict.
He was too strict.
Too strict? He used to beat me every day. Every day.
How did I beat you? With a stick?
No, with your hand, with a strap, he used to beat me every day. I could have grown up to be a drug addict. Or a criminal.
He offered you drugs.
Or a criminal.
But you weren't brought up in that kind of a household, I'm sorry.
Or in that kind of neighborhood.
You were brought up in a household that knew right from wrong.
That's
and
right.
Did right and...
emphasized education.
Don't think for a moment that you are what you are by yourself. You're not. You had help. You had help from parents, you listened, don't give all the credit to you.
You had an idea.
The nail.
That you could write a script. That you're a big shot. That's a lot of hokum. Don't mean a thing.
You still would be, I'd still be better off if I was a druggist, right?
By the my hand, maybe you would be. Maybe you would do more business as a druggist than you did as an actor.
I probably would do more business as a druggist.
I actually think more people would come into the drugstore than go to the films. That's probably true.
Mistakes, maybe you would be better.
That's right. If I had a good drugstore, I'd probably get a bigger audience than I get for my movies. Now, so how do you feel now about the fact that both Christopher and I go out with Asian women?
I personally don't think it's right.
You go where?
That's me, my opinion.
With Chinese women,
Joe. Chinese, Asian.
Chinese.
Neither one is Chinese.
Not Chinese.
I would have liked him from the beginning to fall in love with a nice Jewish girl.
A nice Jewish girl?
Yes.
They have a nice movie.
That's why the Jews someday will be not in your time, be extinct, and that's very bad.
This is truly the lunch from hell.
Okay. So, doing this film was a lot of fun, but also a tremendous amount of work. We work 16 to 18 hours a day in Europe, and because we went to 18 different cities, I had to end up doing a lot of the documentary sound because the sound recordist that was with us would have to run to a venue and set up. And sometimes Woody would be so funny and so hilarious that I'd be sitting there doing sound and I'd be doubled over in laughter, sort of just hoping none of it would be on the soundtrack. And we also got total access, which was, you know, part of the deal, because I said I wouldn't do it unless I had total access. And into the project, I kept hoping and praying that Woody would say, okay, enough. You know, we just want to be left alone, leave us alone. but he never did. So we never got to eat in any nice restaurants in Paris or Venice or Turin or Rome. And, you know, if we got a sandwich, we were lucky. But he basically let me do whatever I wanted. And sometimes he wouldn't even know when we were filming. We're very good at guerrilla-style filming, and we'd always put radio mics on, you know, Suni and Letty and Woody, and just go for it. But I like how the film turned out. I got a lot of criticism when I first started doing the film, but, you know, my feeling is that I'm going to do these things in my life, and that everybody's entitled to have a fair shake. And what came out of it for me was that, you know, Suni, you didn't see it in these scenes, but in other scenes in the film, is really quite a remarkable woman. And she's very strong, she's very smart. And Woody, when he was in Europe, was just totally out of control. He didn't know what was around any corner, and he was totally nervous. And she just led him everywhere, and she would say things to him like, don't forget to thank the band and introduce them, and, you know, sort of all the gracious things of life that Woody would, it would never dawn on Woody to do. So it was quite revealing. You would think that, you know, after working, you know, over 20 years in this industry, that, you know, I'd be able to maybe do some of the films that I really want to do and not have to struggle so much. And my dream is that somebody out there someday will say, yes, you've paid your dues, and, you know, you can do, you know, at least a film a year, and all you have to do is tell us what you want, and we'll give you the budget to do it. But that, of course, is a dream, and that doesn't happen ever. And so I'm going to show you a clip of a film in a minute that is sort of my new myth of Sisyphus, like American Dream and like Harlan County. I've been working on it since 1994. It's called My Generation. That's the working title. You're going to see a work in progress. It's often Avid, which is a linear editing machine, and sometimes there might be a few little blank spots, but, you know, it's pretty much there. And I haven't been able to raise the money to finish it. PolyGram started the film with me, and then after 2 months decided that they didn't want to make the film, that they didn't even want to do the second Woodstock concert in 1994, but they had an ironclad contract with the Woodstock Ventures people, so they had to do it, so the only thing that they could drop was the film. And of course, I was so involved in doing it by then that there was no way that I was going to stop. So I just did it on my own from February until September. And my friends and family just said, you have really gone overboard because you don't even own the rights or anything. But I just figured, I don't care. I wasn't going to let a small thing like money stop me from doing something that I really wanted to do. The film is about who we are today and who we were 25 years ago, now 30 years ago. And we're not so very different than, you know, the 69 generation. That we're still all people who are looking for a sense of ritual and a sense of community. The film is about the three original promoters who did Woodstock 69, and here they are, these guys in their 50s, still doing Woodstock, you know, get a life, guys, but they're still doing it. It's about the people of Saugerties, New York, who had the 1994 concert, and they needed the income, because they got a percentage of the tickets, but they were dreadfully afraid that this new generation, the so-called Generation X, was going to come in and rape their wives and daughters, and so they picked up guns to try to protect themselves. The film is also about inside PolyGram, how the baby boomers are marketing to the so-called Generation Xers and having very big, important board meetings and making decisions about how many condoms do you think will be sold and, you know, what kind of ice cream will be the sponsor. Haagen-Dazs is in, Ben and Jerry's is out. And it's also the heart and soul of the film is Generation X, who they are, what their dreams are. You get to know probably some of your favorite bands, who they are as people, like Porno for Pyros and Metallica and Chili Peppers. And of course, there's, you know, Bob Dylan and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Allen Ginsberg and a lot of other people who are in it. And so I'm going to show you a little clip of this film, just starting it at the beginning, and it's number 11.
I got a machine, and I took over the world in one weekend. I took over the world with my machine. Either take over the world or learn French. So I took over the world. And next weekend, I can learn French.
I took over the world in one weekend.
I got a machine and I took over the world.
Because, you know, the 25th anniversary of anything sort of brings to mind an opportunity to celebrate it. And because it seems like it's a good time to do it, feels right. And because we think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'd like to see what happens, really, I guess. I'd like to see what people make of it. And whether they carry sort of a traditional spirit into this event or not.
Freedom, freedom.
I mean, I think kids have been tortured by the 60s, in that it was such a, you know, an interesting time to be a kid. You know, and comparisons keep getting made between the 60s and the 90s. then I think it's an interesting opportunity to let them have their own event. I mean, I think it's better to do things than not to. So I think we would regret it if we didn't try to do this event.
It's going to be interesting to see what the world is like in terms of the kids today.
Woodstock 94. The concert you've waited your whole life for.
Probably a lot of people feel the same way I do, but I'm just like sick of hearing about the 60s. I'm tired of being force-fed anything pertaining to Woodstock 25 years after the fact. It's like a certain, you know, generation segment of people still recycling their youth experience long after it's passed. We had a great time in the 60s. We had drugs, sex, and free love, and all that, and music. And then we had a great time in the 80s too, because we were making all this money. Now we're selling you back all the music and the concerts we had and the festivals we had. And what do you guys have? You guys, Generation X, you never had anything like this. So trust us, ours is the definitive. And it's like, not to say that this generation needs.
From the Abbott, it'll come back again.
The board will need to approve a mass gathering permit. Before we take that action, we need to hear from you.
Your concerns about the Woodstock Festival in general.
I don't think anybody here labels all teenage people, you know, killers and rapists and stabbers, but certainly nowadays people do things that are truly outrageous to one another, unprovoked.
Now, if these people know that these women are in the house by themselves.
There'll be plenty of security around. Nobody will be abandoned or left on their own.
But between the time she calls that security person, they could knock her out, they could cut her, they could shoot at her.
We gotta think the worst.
Nobody has to drive all the way up to Saugerties, New York to find a house with a woman in it.
No, we
don't want it. Shoot anybody that comes on my land if I don't want them there. Kevin?
You can't say that.
I can say it.
This generation today is a lot different than it was back in 69. There's a lot of violence and
all kinds of confusion
with the kids, you know, a lot of broken homes, and there's no respect anymore, and we need to get that back into our use.
Violent crime is up 40-some percent since 10 years ago among youth. It's not so much the older people that we're having problems with, it's the younger people.
Kids my age aren't the same as they were 20, 25 years ago.
What are you gonna do?
I'm gonna stay here with a shotgun in my house, so I have to protect it.
Shoot it!
They seem to think that everybody coming in is gonna be bad people, just nothing but druggies and thieves, and I don't think it's gonna be that way at all. I think it's gonna be very hectic, it's gonna be very congested, but in the long run, I think it's gonna be good for the area. It's gonna be like shot in the arm.
The residents in the area are very interested in their own safety.
Probably out of 300,000 kids, 299,000 are going to be wanted. But I'm saying kids, these are young adults. This is Generation X we're talking about here, who have, they're called Generation X because there are problems in that generation.
I feel very confident that if my neighbor's wife or my neighbor's daughter is raped by one of these people, they're going to consider that much more than an inconvenience.
This would be the best thing, because aiming is not that large of a factor with this, because once you pull, you'll cover about at least a 10-15 foot area. Okay?
It makes me sad. People are very afraid of our young people.
The numbers are scary, but the people shouldn't be scary. Mm-hmm. And what are we going to do to house the people? That's a legitimate question, but who are these people? There are people.
Yeah.
I think it's about time we have a little fun in this town and get some music in the mountains.
All right.
If we don't get something going in this town and help build up this whole area, we're all going to be in a heck of a predicament. We won't have a pot to look at, and we won't have a window to throw it out of. I say we should get off the pot and get on with the festival.
What do you hope people that have come to this event will feel? How do you hope they'll feel coming up here?
I mean, I hope that they have a wonderful experience, and I hope they get to take home a little bit of what Woodstock is about, you know, in spirit.
Can it ever be the same?
It's not going to be the same, but the emotional experience can be similar. I mean, obviously, these are different times and different people, but Woodstock is about a sense of community, and I think they can take that away.
In 1969, the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair defined a generation. Now, 25 years later, two more days of peace and music. Woodstock 94, Saturday and Sunday, August 13th and 14th in Saugerties, New York. Not then, now, Woodstock 94. It's not like Woodstock, it is Woodstock.
So you want to talk to me and my kid?
Yes.
So it has to be then, now.
You want that welling up of magic.
Absolutely.
You want your kids to say,
be here now.
I know I missed it, but I don't want to admit to mom and dad that
I wished I did.
Absolutely. And you want mom and dad to say, I'm too old to go, but God, I wish I wasn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
I don't know if I'm going to like all of it, but I got to go anyway.
Yeah.
It's okay. Infused or sort of charged.
Thanks. Anyway, as soon as we get to the concert, the baby boomers are totally pushed out and the new generation takes over. I guess I'm going to conclude, and I guess in conclusion, I want to say that I just really love what I do. It's as if I go on a magical journey every time I do a film, and I don't have to just tell the stories about it. I'm able to really show it to people. And that to me is hugely important. I don't think that, you know, documentaries necessarily change people, but I do think that it enables our world to become a little closer and allows us to communicate a little bit more. And maybe it will change in some way. For example, Harlan County. We showed Harlan County to the members of Congress, and they passed the black lung legislation for the coal miners. Not that the film made that happen, because people had been working on it for a long time, but to be able to show it when people were just about to vote on it really helped. In American Dream, a woman from the audience stood up and she just said, what can I do to help these people in Austin, Minnesota? So it provokes people to want to do things and to be active. And for me, it's just a great honor to be able to come here tonight to show you some of my work and also to be able to bring to you the people that I love so much. So thanks.
That was Barbara Koppel speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 1999. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.